Like Aaron said, my name is Jeremy Nicholson, and I'll be talking to you today about the impacts of a four-lane highway with wildlife underpasses on the abundance and genetic structure of black bears in eastern North Carolina. In the United States, there are over 4 million miles of roads, and unless you're in the swamps of Louisiana and Alaska or one particular place in Yellowstone National Park, you're never more than 22 miles from a road. The potential ecological impacts of the growing highway infrastructure in the United States and elsewhere has recently gained substantial attention in the past couple decades. Highways' impact on wildlife include habitat fragmentation, associated human development, habitat loss, direct mortality, and displacement and avoidance. Of particular interest is habitat fragmentation, which disrupts movement patterns, alters social structure, and creates small isolated populations. Small isolated populations may experience reduced genetic diversity, which may ultimately lead to reduced survival and reproduction. In the past couple of decades, mitigation efforts have been implemented to reduce these impacts. One type of design is a basic design here is an exclusion fence, which purpose is just to parallel a highway and keep an animal from crossing the highway. However, this also impedes natural movements. Other designs, including culverts, overpasses, and underpasses, help facilitate wildlife movement across the highways. However, few studies have quantitatively assessed the impacts highways have on wildlife, and furthermore, the effectiveness of mitigation efforts, such as the ones I showed you, are poorly understood. And this is a problem because the expansion of highways is thought to increase in the near future. An example of expansion is Highway 64 from Raleigh to the Outer Banks has been increasing over the last 10 years from a two-lane highway to a four-lane highway. A portion of this highway from Roper to Creswell was also increased from a two-lane to a four-lane, and it dissected prime wildlife habitat. Many people were concerned, so Department of Transportation included in the design three wildlife underpasses. The primary species of concern was black bears. They are particularly affected by habitat fragmentation because they use landscapes on a large scale. So this makes them an ideal study species for determining the impacts of highways on wildlife. They are also known as the umbrella species because the proper management of black bear also benefits many other species. A little timeline here. In 2000, the University of Tennessee, in collaboration with the Department of Transportation and Department of Natural Resources, initiated the first phase of a two-phase study looking at the impacts of highways on black bears before and after construction. In 2001, field work was completed, which resulted in two MS theses and several publications. September 2005, highway construction was completed, and the following year, in May 2006, The second phase of the study began. The objectives of my study is to compare the abundance and density of black bears between the two phases of the study, as well as the genetic structure of black bears between the two phases of the study. I also want to look at and determine the mitigation value of the three wildlife underpasses. My study takes place in Washington County, North Carolina, which is approximately 1 hour to 1.5 hours from the Outer Banks. My study area is broken up into a control and treatment area. The control matches the treatment area closely in regard to the amount of land, forested land, which is about 60% of the land, and 40% agricultural crops. The forested land is dominated by an overstory of loblolly pine with a midstory of sugar maple, sweet gum, and tulip poplars, and an understory of cane, devil's walking stick, greenbrier, and blackberry. The primary crops in the area is wheat, corn, soybeans, cotton, and peanuts. A little introduction to my methods and timeline. I'll be live trapping, which I started last summer in 06, and I also completed during the spring and summer this 07. I'll also be looking at the hair sampling data I gathered during the fall of 2006, and I will use that data and analyze the data during this fall of 07 and next spring. I selected trap site based on sign of the area, including scat, tracks, marked trees, and in areas of food availability to the black bears. As you can see on the bottom right corner is crop degradation due to black bears. I also put out traps in areas that were successful from the first phase of the study. To trap bears, I used spring-activated Aldridge foot snares modified with automobile springs to prevent injuries. A picture on the right side is an example of a completed trap site minus the bait. After bears were caught, I mobilized them with a mixture of 2-to-1 ketamine xylazine. And we've done the normal standard measurements such as weight and length and stuff like that. But specifically for my study, I took a tissue sample from the ear and a hair sample from usually from the forearm and an upper premolar for aging data. Next, I'll go into my hair sampling design. In the first phase of the study, they randomly selected 70 hair site locations in the forested tracts of their two study areas, which equaled 140 overall. I chose my locations to get as close to them as I possibly could. This diagram shows how our traps sound, our hair trap designs, and basically we put 15x5 gauge barbed wire and stretched it around 3-4 trees, approximately 40 to 50 centimeters off the ground. We hung bait in the middle, and we made a trap site that was approximately 5x5 meters, or just big enough to keep the bears from entering and getting the bait without having to go over or under the barbed wire. Oh yeah, I didn't mention earlier, we had their traps out for a 7-week period. Here's an actual picture of our hair trap design. I'm not sure if you can see anything on that, but here's what it looks like in the field. For the 7 weeks, we sampled once a week each trap site. Any trap sites that or any samples that contained greater than 5 hairs was collected and taken to the field house to be used later for data analysis. We selected 25 samples from each sampling period and 1 sample from each of those sites. We will use 10 genetic markers from the hair samples to identify black bear individuals and look at the genetic diversity. Specifically, we'll be using microsatellite, which are stretches of DNA that consist of tandem repeats of a simple sequence of nucleotides. We also use microsatellites because they're highly variable, and what I mean by this is that at each locus there's a high variability of alleles which can help identify a unique individual. We can also use polymerase chain reaction to amplify microsatellites, which is very beneficial to our study. Hair analysis is broken down into DNA extraction, DNA amplification, and DNA sequencing. I'll be performing the extraction and amplification. Amplification also involves a PCR, which I talked about earlier, and I don't have time to tell you about it exactly how it happens, but basically it takes 1 sample of our DNA strand, and in 3 hours we can amplify it into 20 million copies, which greatly reduces the quantity and the quality of DNA required during our sampling. After the PCR is done, we will send it off to the main campus to undergo a procedure called fragment analysis. This will provide a unique DNA profile for each sample. Mark recapture experiments have been used for a long time to estimate population, density, and abundance. However, they have several shortcomings, including sampling bias and small sample sizes. Therefore, and recently, non-invasive genetic sampling has been gaining popularity because it has advantages over the conventional methods, including increased capture probability, decreased tag loss, and it's way less intrusive than live trapping. However, every method is not perfect, and unique marking of individuals is sometimes a problem using genetic methods, because the assumption that individuals are uniquely marked may be violated when one or more individuals share the same genotype. This is known as the shadow effect. Shared genetic profiles can lead to different individuals being classified as the same animal and being mistaken as a recapture when in fact they are not. The ability of molecular markers to determine individuals can be found using the probability statistic for individual alleles, multi-locus, multiple alleles, and for siblings. Marker capture studies are based upon two models, open population models, which allows for additions and losses to the population, and closed models, which does not allow for addition and losses to the populations. I'll be only using closed models because we sampled during a relatively short time period of 7 weeks when no births occurred and deaths were not likely significant. It wasn't during hunting season and when immigration and immigration was probably not significant. Multiple mark recapture models are used when there are greater than two sampling periods. The first model is the equal catchability model, which assumes the population is closed and the animals do not lose their marks. All marks are recognized during each trapping session, and every animal is equal at risk of capture. However, many people know that the last assumption is not realistic. Therefore, there's been models created to relax the assumption of equal catchability. The first model involves varying degrees of behavior, such as trap, shyness, trap, happy individuals. The second model allows for variability in capture probabilities due to, it's called the heterogeneity model, and allows for capture probabilities to vary according to things like age and sex of the bears. And the last one involves the timing of events, such as severe storms might change the capture probability. And finally, you can add all those different models into one, and you can combine all those models. After I estimate the population size, I can divide that by the effective study size and get an estimate of density. Now I'll move on to the genetic structure portion of my study, which involves I'll be looking at genetic relatedness, heterozygosity, and population structure. When populations are subdivided, difference in allele frequencies are known to occur. I'll be looking at the proportion of shared alleles among individuals, between the study areas, between subpopulations of the study areas, and between north and south of the expanded highway. Heterozygosity is one of the most basic measures of genetic variation, and it is the probability that a given individual in a population will have multiple alleles at a given locus. Low levels of genetic variation may indicate that there is inbreeding depression and low genetic variation in your population. Next, I'll look at gene flow, which is the average number of migrants exchanged between local populations per generation. A rule of thumb is that one migrant per population is sufficient to minimize the loss of heterozygosity and polymorphism in population and subpopulations. Finally, I will look at Wright's F statistic, which separates components of genetic variation into hierarchical levels. I'll do this by measuring the reduction in heterozygosity in subpopulations relative to the total population. After using all my methods, I'll have four different groups of data. I will conclude differences exist between the first phase of the study and that the highway has an impact if only one and two, if data groups one and two are different, adjusting for differences in groups data three and four. I'd like to thank Dr. Frank Van Manning, my major professor, the University of Tennessee for allowing me to do this project, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Wildlife Resource Commission, and the Weyerhaeuser Company for letting us use their land. I'd like to give special thanks to Matthew McAllister, my other grad student working on my project with me, my wife, Tanya, and all the other technicians that helped me, as well as Laura Thompson and Jason Kendall, the first phase study graduate students. Is there any questions?
Questions? We have 5 minutes.
If not.
You mentioned that one migrant per generation would be okay. As long as you've got that much, things are okay. Which doesn't seem like very much, so I'm just wondering, do you have any sense of how big a difference there needs to be for you to be able to detect that in your study design?
I use the one migrant rule as a rule of thumb, but I've also seen studies that said that there needs to be 3 or 4 migrants, up to 10 migrants. So as I learn more about the data and stuff, I will look more into that. And
I'm, so I guess my question is, you've got about, I think, 5 or 6 year gap between the two periods. Have you kind of worked through the numbers at all and figure out like how many layers you need to get, how much drift there need to be able to pick it up, like a sensitivity analysis?
I have not worked through anything like that. Sorry, I've just taken the data and I ain't even analyzed it yet. And I ain't read further enough into the literature to determine that right now.
Because I guess, I mean, what I'm driving at is like you might not find a difference.
Well,
and then how would you interpret that? Would that mean things are okay, or?
Well, when we started this project, we knew that there might not be a difference initially right after in genetic stuff, but there might be. We wanted to find the initial response. One of the biggest things we're looking at is abundance and density, and it can quickly change after a highway goes in because of dispersal. There's several wildlife refuges around the area, so the highway might make the animals leave, but as far as genetic variation, we're not sure if in fact it's going to change, but we're just going to look and see.
I mean, I think it's a great thing to do because it's a baseline for, you know, 15 years on.
Yeah, we want to look at initial response, and maybe 10, 15 years down the line, it'd be really neat to come back and see what was happening.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
You are comparing genetics between both sides of the highway, right, both areas. Are there any,
we picked the
characteristic to it. Are there equal populations roughly on both sides?
Oh, the populations, abundance?
Yeah, could that have an effect on the genetics as well? I don't know.
Well, there was slight difference in habitat, and the control area had twice as many animals last time as
the area with the contiguous forest?
Yeah.
On the bottom or left?
Yeah. But the question was, is the habitat structure affect population abundance? And the answer was, yes, it did last time.
And genetics or not? Fewer individuals?
Well, the average heterozygosity on the control and treatment area was roughly similar. There was other differences, but.
I might have misunderstood you, but you said you're taking the upper premolar, and if so, have you seen any, is there any side effects to taking a molar out of the bear?
About 25% of our bears die because of that, but no, I'm just kidding. It don't affect an amala. It's just a tiny little premolar right behind the canine, and it don't bother them at all. It ain't used in eating or anything like that. Any other questions? All right, thank you.